Okay, this is a continuation, tape two with Walter Gordon. Okay, go ahead.
So, the stenographic recording was typed up, and it was passed around, and Mr. Kenyard, the reporter, was besieged for copies. And it became a big deal. And then Judge Nye, who had called me in earlier, called me to his chambers. And Judge Nye was no question about Judge Nye being a very prejudiced man. It was, he and I knew it. And he looked me in the eye and he says, "Mr. Gordon," he says, "I read that recording." And he says, "I have this to say. My only regret is that you didn't say more." Well, that was a vindication for me. And the presiding judge of the whole court system took over, and Judge Scott, who had been presiding up there in the criminal department and being a very prominent figure up there among all the attorneys, and one of these good, hailing guys, was transferred by the presiding judge to an obscure little courtroom way over in a very isolated building. And he was there for years afterwards. And about 15 years later, I was up on a civil case, and the presiding judge was getting ready to send us, and they were looking for a courtroom. So the judge, this was the sequel. The judge called me up to the bench and said, "Mr. Gordon, we have one court open. You have the Blodgett case, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "We have one case court open. That's Judge A.A. Scott." He said, "I wasn't around when it happened, but," he says, "someone has told me that a lot of things happened between you and Judge Scott." And Judge Scott is willing to take this case with and call bygones, if you're willing. I said, "Yes, I'm willing." So they sent my case over to Judge Scott, and he handled the case. But there was a just between us, there was the firm politeness. There was no great affection, demonstration of affection or forgiveness or anything like that. It's just that. Every election that came up that he had to face, the candidates all raised this case. And there was one Spanish judge who finally was elected, but he didn't win from Scott. Joe Scott was a powerful man in this town. That was the race was a boogaboo and was raised in every election, you know, thereafter. That was an incident that was something.
Very, and, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, my wife and I went to Farmer's Market a couple of times, and Scott now, an old man, came walking through in his raincoat. And you remember that incident, don't you, dear? Came walking through in his raincoat, and he nodded. And that's the way it ended up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's a good story. We need to wrap this up, I think. But I just want to ask you like two more questions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you what your greatest successes have been in your life.
Oh, that is a subject that I've just never stopped to think about, you know. Whether there were successes or just events, I've never classified or thought about anything being enormous success. It's just a kind of a daily routine, and it's been an enjoyable experience. I've loved the practice of law. I've thought about how fortunate I was to just make the right guess to go into the right thing, because I came so close to missing everything. So I'll say this too, that nearly everything that happened to me, I thought out first, and I knew which way I was going. And I looked like a fool lots of instances, but in my deep down, I thought it out. I took certain risk, calculated risk, and I didn't make any great success, but nevertheless, I'm satisfied.
What about disappointments?
Disappointments? Oh, I've had so many. But I don't. I figure like this, that when you're out here and you're fighting life's battle, you lose some, you win some. I've never been able to reconcile my father and mother's death to me personally. When you ask about anything that does make you feel good, I think maybe my relationship with my mother and father was probably the greatest and the finest rewarding thing in my life. Let me tell you, it's kind of a interesting takeoff. My dad was a difficult man. He was a strong disciplinarian. He was tough, but he was for me. And my mother was a modest, intelligent, very sensitive woman, and refined. And she wanted all the good things in life. And she was not impatient with my father. And they both loved me. And I saw my father, because of his illness, he had heart trouble. He developed certain illusions and phobias to go with his trouble. And he began to find fault with my mother. And now here he's an old man. He was accusing my mother of everything. And my mother would come to me and say, poor old man, sympathize with him. And she had to bear all this stuff. But I was her refuge. And then just on the other hand, my dad, with all this, these illnesses and faulty thinking, I was fortunate enough that he fastened on me for his affection. And he had perfect confidence in me. And he would come over and go to sleep in my house, back of my house. He'd be waiting there when I got through. And so here I had love on both sides. Now, and I was the one that have to tell my father. I'll show you how he, as old as he was, I think he was, at that time, he was 65 or 60. He picked up a fight with another old gentleman because he thought the other old gentleman was paying too much attention to my mother, one of those kind of things. I had to go and pacify him and talk to him, just like he was a baby. And it was right in the midst of all this that this tragedy happened, where this man killed them both. I get a great, since it did happen, I get a great satisfaction of knowing the love they had for me. And this is the thing that sustained me through the tragedy, you see. It might be difficult for you to understand that, but it wasn't the case where my dad went away hating me or finding fault with me or criticizing me for moving from the home or any of those things. Just perfect relationship. And then this thing happened, see. Now, I told you that after I discovered that he had transferred this property and everything, I told you how I could go down and look at him. The reason I told you that is because the grief was so great at first, I just hated to see them. But when I found out he had transferred this property and done something wrong, just something wrong to me, I was strong enough to go down there and just say, look him right straight in the eye and say, Pop, I was a man to you.
And that's it. Yeah. I have one last question. What do you do now, and what are your plans for the future?
Right now, I have no plans for the future except continue to work and do my work if I can. My health holds up, and I'm thinking a great deal about the physical side. I've talked to other relatives of mine, some in medicine. They tell me that an old man's legs give out first, so I'm being very careful about my legs, and I'm walking. And I hope to, I'll be 86 in June coming. I hope if I can make it, just ease along to 95, then I'll be willing to fight from 95 on.
You might think of retiring maybe in around 95.
I will retire. I want you to know that I'll retire anytime, just when I think I can't make it anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I don't want to be a burden on, you know, sometimes old men push things too far. They end up losing the capacity to do their best, and I don't want to do that. So that's about it.
And I just remembered one other thing that you were going to tell me about, but what I never asked you was about the lottery, the Chinese lottery.
Oh, yeah. That,
will you tell me just that piece?
There was a time when every black barbershop, they had a rear room, and the Chinese would come in that rear room, and on that rear room wall would be all types of tickets in Chinese insignias, and they would sell lottery tickets back there. And this, and people, women, it'd be a men's barbershop, but women and men would file in and out buying those lottery tickets. And I remember you'd hear about a 7 spot and a 3 spot and so forth. And I sometimes wondered whether or not they're the same things that are used in Keno games. I don't know. But the Chinese lottery was a well-established thing in the 30s.
Was that just locally here in Los Angeles?
No, I think, I better not give an opinion about the rest of the country, but I know this, it's a gang of them here.
And so like, what would you win, or how did it work? You bought a number?
You'd hear people winning $1,000, $5,000, yeah.
And that was, it was legal?
And
it was all
illegal.
It was
but, it was very illegal, but the police setup in those days, in the 30s, permitted all that stuff to go on. And the police were grabbing and taking money from these people. And if you remember, Clinton, the restaurant man, white, ran a big cafeteria downtown, took up a role of crusader against the mayor of the town at that time. And this crusade grew stronger and stronger and ended up in a bombing of a detective by the name of Raymond, who was working for Clinton. and Raymond, in the end, were able to secure evidence to convict the one of the top sheriffs of the town. They convicted him and sent him to the penitentiary. Mayor Byron went out, and it wasn't Byron that went out. It was Shaw, Joe Shaw, went out, and Byron, a judge, came in, and this a well-known attorney, Cooper, was a leader in the movement to oust Shaw. You ever hear of Clinton's cafeteria?
Is it Clifton's?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's still there.
It's still there, and you can get served and by paying what you want. I don't know whether it's changed then. But in those days, you could go in there and pay whatever you thought was reasonable.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And he's the one who started the crusade against the then existing mayor. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, this has been a fascinating interview, Mr. Gordon.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm just tickled to death that you pleased.
Oh, very much.
All right.
Thank you.